Georgia's DBHDD reminds people that the Good Samaritan Law can save lives during alcohol and drug overdoses. People are urged to call 911 and stay until help arrives. More information at opioidresponse.info.
Thanks for listening to the Political Rewind podcast. Be sure to like and follow us and rate us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. Richard Rodgers and Oscar Hammerstein said it in Carousel. June is busting out all over. It is June 1st. And even though the official summer, start of summer still off a little way, summer is underway. Schools are out, of course, so the weather is heating up. And we've said it over and over again. This used to be a time when politics slowed down. And we would scramble to figure out what to talk about on shows like Political Rewind. The newspaper had some issues in how much they could write about politics in off-season. But there's no such thing as an off-season anymore in politics, as we will discover in our show today. Let me get right to our panel and begin discussing a variety of issues for the show. Kevin Riley is my partner on the Thursday show from the AJC. Kevin, of course, is recently retired as editor-in-chief and now editor-at-large. How are you, Kevin?
Bill, it's great to be here, especially on a short week. I woke up in a panic this morning, afraid that I'd missed the show somehow or it was the wrong day. So thanks for straightening me out on that June 1st date.
I'll sing you that song from Carousel a little later, Kevin, but I won't do it.
We can all look forward to that, yes.
Margaret Coker, editor-in-chief of The Current, which is based down in Savannah, and which covers the news of the coast, but really covers all of Georgia in its online format at The Current, thecurrentga.org. How are you, Margaret?
Thanks. I'm glad to be here and excited to tell your listeners about Georgia's newest historic marker that's commemorating one of our original suffragists here in Savannah, Mamie George Williams.
I'm glad we're going to get a chance to talk about that later. As you know, I saw that on your website the other day and thought it was a wonderful story, and we'll get to it a little later in the show. And around our journalists on today's show, Chauncey Alcorn, reporter for Capital B, is back with us. Chauncey, I think you'd agree with me, things just aren't slowing down at any point anymore, are they?
Never a dull moment in Georgia politics, and a pleasure as always to join you, Bill.
And we're also joined by Professor Tammy Greer, professor of political science, now off on a summer vacation with her triplets. Are you going to send them off to camp at some point this summer, Tammy?
Yes, camp starts Tuesday. So they get to enjoy camp for 6 weeks.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, thank you all so much for being here for today's show. Let's start with what, of course, has been the biggest story in politics for a week now and will continue to be in the days ahead. Last night, the U.S. House did in fact pass the compromise measure that Kevin Riley and President Biden's teams put together that allows for the debt ceiling to be raised by June 5th, which the Treasury Department, Janet Yellen says, is now the day at which the country will run out of money to pay its bills. The vote was 314 to 117, so it wasn't even close. But what's fascinating about this is that Republicans provided 149 votes for the measure, while Democrats had to do the heavier lifting. 165 Democrats voted for it. And Kevin Riley, as we also know, four Georgia members of the U.S. House voted against the measure, but the deal is done in the House. Now it goes to the Senate.
Yeah, Bill, I have to mention, I'm sure your listeners caught this, but a little slip of the tongue. You said President Biden and Kevin Riley worked out this deal. I did follow it closely. and had a lot of thoughts about it that I wanted to share with the president. But instead, he chose to speak with that other Kevin McCarthy, the Speaker of the House. And I actually think McCarthy is the story on this, which is he couldn't actually muster enough Republican votes to really, you know, get this passed. He had to depend on the Democrats. So there are questions about whether he can last in that job. On the other hand, he did position himself as negotiating directly with the president and as a powerful person in this situation. So it remains to be seen whether he can maintain control of his caucus in the House of Representatives and what other kinds of things are going to come up as this term goes along.
Chauncey, we can talk about the overall measure and the fact that, yes, Kevin McCarthy, thank you for the correction, Kevin Riley, what problems he may face in the days ahead. But let's talk about the Georgians. Three Republicans, Rich McCormick, Andrew Clyde, and Mike Collins, voted against the measure, and so did Democrat Nkema Williams. So it's interesting. Nkema Williams was quoted in the AJC as saying, "While I'm glad that our party bailed out the Republican Party, a dig at McCarthy, and passed this so that we're not facing a catastrophic default on our debt in this country, I had to make sure I was uplifting the voices of the people who are left out of the conversation." Among her concerns, I assume she's saying, Chauncey, is that there is a work requirement added to the measure that Republicans insisted be in there, work requirement for food stamps. Chauncey?
Yeah, there was a great piece in The Atlantic yesterday that talked about basically the co-signing of the president on this work requirement issue, which is dumb disproportionately and seems to be, you know, a dig at people who are impoverished, who need these benefits, and, you know, increasing their requirements on them is just a way to kind of dig at the poor, the working poor, who, you know, need these benefits to survive in some cases and to pay and to pay for their food and pay bills. It's interesting to me that the perception of who's winning and who's losing in this argument, I think is going for the most part in Democrats' favor. There certainly Speaker McCarthy is going to be getting a lot of push from the right on this, who basically think it wasn't painful enough, frankly, for Biden, you know, looking a year out from the election, and how this, you know, could potentially have been catastrophic. Any, the economy is always a key issue in any presidential election, and you certainly a default and the likely recession it would trigger would not have been good for the president. And but it's also possible that that could have been bad for perceived as a, you know, Republicans being blamed for this as well. So I think obviously for most folks, assuming that the Senate does pass this in the coming days and the debt ceiling does get raised, it's going to be a net win for Americans that the economy will not tank, particularly in Georgia with 13 you know, military bases and lots of military veterans and federal employees who would be impacted by a default and, you know, a resulting shutdown as a result.
Margaret, you're welcome to weigh in on any of what we've already begun talking about, but let me add one element. Rich McCormick was asked why he voted against the bill, and he said this. GOP leadership negotiated with President Biden in good faith, understanding the limitations of our position. But I am a no on the compromise because it fails to address the root problems of Washington spending addiction. And Margaret, I have to say, this is exactly what's wrong with the way this whole debt ceiling confrontation seems to always play out these days. This is not a bill on spending. It is simply a mechanism that allows the government to pay for bills already incurred.
That's correct. And what gets lost in a lot of these sound bites is that both parties, when they take power on a federal level, they love to spend. They just have different priorities on what they want to spend our money on. And so this is, we'll, you know, in deep in the weeds of what the House just passed, you'll see some of those conflicting priorities, right? There's new new language in there that's going to help streamline new permits for energy companies to both dig and possibly get more domestic oil and other energy sources in the U.S. As we've already mentioned, there's new work requirements for working people who are need food stamps in order to pay their bills, as Chauncey has said. So there is a lot of different layers of this very important debate that we're having right now as a nation. At the final analysis, though, it seems like both parties, instead of having, you know, a high noon shootout, have actually put their guns down and come to the table and made some sort of compromise. And I think that's exactly what every poll in America for years and years now has said that they want from our government. We want compromise. We don't want extremists to be in power. And I would take a slightly different tack than the rest of our panelists so far and say that I think one of the biggest winners here is President Biden himself. You know, he has spent his entire life in Congress, his adult life in Congress, and he has always built himself as a master negotiator and someone who knows the way of you know, the power avenues in Washington, D.C. He and his team, spent most of last week huddled with Speaker McCarthy, and they took out the rest of the congressional Democratic leadership and went one-on-one as a president who thinks he knows best when it comes to crafting compromise legislation. Then they also spent hours and hours over Memorial Day weekend briefing then congressional Democratic leadership and committee members so that everyone felt comfortable going back and supporting what is indeed a compromise. So compromise has been a terrible, dirty word in American politics. It looks like that this might actually be the word of our next weekend and the coming days as we bypass this terrible cliff edge that we've been on.
Tammy, you know what? A South Carolina Republican Congresswoman, Nancy Mace, would agree that President Biden scored a victory. She came out against the measure from the compromise from the start. But once it was being introduced to be voted on, she tweeted out, and just typical of the kind of crude approach to social media that we see so much of, she said, "President Biden's a guy who can't even find his pants, and yet he beat us in terms of the way this agreement worked out." But it still has to go to the Senate, and there are members on both sides of the aisle who have some significant problems with this compromise, Tammy.
Right. So I've always found that people who call names really don't have any facts to stand on, so it's better to create a distraction. So, Bill, what I found very interesting in this whole discussion is that in 114th Congress, Collins, Isaacson, and Perdue from Georgia all voted for to raise the debt ceiling. In the 115th Congress, which is after the Trump tax cuts, Collins voted yes. In the 116th Congress, Collins voted yes. So it appears to be, it just depends on who's in office, whether or not some people will have this this stance against the raising the debt ceiling. So I find that fascinating. I also find it, you know, this is almost symbiotic of John Boehner. So it's a deja vu moment. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with McCarthy, especially when he gave up that, you know, this notion of one person can bring to the floor of the House, whether or not the speaker can maintain. To echo everyone else's point, you know, the purpose of divided government, divided Congress, and the U.S. form of government is compromise. It's in the Constitution. This is one of the things that I find very fascinating, that the masses, the majority, are lost when there's a compromise. The extremes take up all the space, yet the majority of Congress, that was a huge yes vote in Congress to say yes to raising the debt ceiling. I also find it interesting, sometimes I don't know if we say it plainly enough, that the House of Representatives is a politically driven entity because they're on a two-year cycle, as compared to every other level and every other entity, appears to be more of a governing stance because they have to do more.
Let's be careful about one aspect of this, Tammy. Matt Collins did, in fact, vote for debt ceiling raises through his career. His son, Mike Collins, who's a freshman, has now cast the vote against the debt ceiling. Nevertheless, I think your point is fair that the party seems to vote for or against it, depending on who's in the White House. Kevin?
Yeah, I want to build on what Tammy said. I mean, in the end, 149 Republicans voted for this and 165 Democrats. And so it was a big victory by a large margin, and only 71 Republicans voted against it and 46 Democrats opposed it. And it is a bit of the, I just don't know how else to say it, but the fault of the media that twice as many Republicans voted for it, but we're hearing about by proportion, the very small number who voted against it. And, sort of same with the Democrats. And I get that journalistic impulse, and it's a necessity to at least represent those who voted against it. But this was not close. This point of view of we ought to default so that we can get our way is not at all what most people want. And it's important to remember that.
So, Chauncey, I've said a couple times this week that there are things that are kind of like optical illusions in this compromise. For instance, I do understand why Democrats are concerned about this added work requirement that extends the requirement from age 49 to 55 before people can get food stamps. But the simple fact of the matter is, in theory, Democrats don't want any work requirement at all. I understand that. But in practical terms, the way this compromise is written, more people are going to be covered by food stamps. And in fact, the cost of food stamps is going to increase in the budget ahead because veterans are exempted from the work requirement. The homeless are exempted from the work requirement, as are others. So in some ways, this is part of the illusion that Republicans got what they wanted out of this. Again, I get it. Democrats think work requirements are awful, period, and that Biden should never agree to it. But go ahead and respond to what I'm asking about.
Yeah, I think you kind of underscored one of the points of why President Biden is being perceived as winning on this issue. This could have been a lot worse. If the debt ceiling didn't get raised, which it still hasn't, but if assuming that it's on its way, but it could have been calamitous for the economy. And it seemed like going into this that Republicans held all the bargaining chips, and they could, President Biden initially had said he wasn't going to negotiate on raising the debt ceiling and ultimately capitulated on that. It could have been a lot worse in terms of that regard. But I think on principle, this myth, longstanding myth of the welfare queen Reagan era Republicans have been touting since the 80s is one that, still stands today. And, as though federal spending on, safety net programs is anywhere near what it is, say, on military spending or, subsidies for corporations. And Democrats oppose that on that principle that, there's certainly way more money that goes into the budget on those other items than does, food stamps or, free lunch for poor people when the kids going to school. So I think that's the reason.
Margaret, and then Tammy. Margaret, first, you track Buddy Carter, your congressman down there in the first district, very closely in the current. A headline that you had the other day was Carter tiptoes through debt ceiling saga. Now, he ended up voting for it, but you use him as an example of how cautious Republicans particularly have had to be in talking about this deal.
Yeah, it really has been a minefield for Republicans like our first district representative, Buddy Carter, because They have come to office talking the talk of fiscal responsibility, and there's nothing more fiscally irresponsible than allowing the U.S. to default on its debt payments. So trying to walk that line has been tough. I will say that Buddy Carter has made made quite a name for himself as being the person to lick his finger, stick it up, and see which way the wind's blowing and vote accordingly. He's not someone who is a natural cohort with the Freedom Caucus, although sometimes he votes with them, sometimes he votes against them. His district is, it's interesting because as the real donor money set of Republicans here in Chatham County are very much sort of middle of the road Republicans in today's parlance, the base is moving more and more away from the Kemp wing of our state party and more towards the Trump wing. The newly elected representative for our district's Republicans going to the state convention next week is Candace Taylor, who is anything but a pro-Kemp Republican. So Buddy Carter is going to Columbus next week. Candace Taylor is going to Columbus next week. Everyone is going to Columbus next week, trying to figure out what personality they're going to bring to voters moving into 2024. And I think that ultimately is what Buddy Carter's tightrope has been about, how he's going to position himself for his next run at office, whatever office that's going to be, rather than any real ideology about what spending priorities he wants or the people in the first district want.
Thank you for that. Tammy, let me give you the last word before we've got to get to a break.
Sure. It's important, I think, for us to be clear about this work requirement thing, because it's thrown out there just as a work requirement. It's important to note that states are the ones that manage food stamps and the SNAP program, not the federal government. So if a state has high unemployment, then more people are put into that pool. And so the work requirement is not as heavy on those particular states or even municipalities that have high unemployment because they don't have the available jobs. So the blanketed statement, Bill, to your point, that you know this is hindering a particular set of people is not true when you look at it on a case-by-case basis, which again goes to the importance of voting on your state and local level and not just your federal level when it comes to spending federal funds that go directly to the people. Also, that there are the compromises that are in the bill that passed last night, there are cuts for items that Republicans want, and there are cuts for items that Democrats want. So again, to what we talked about at the very beginning, this is a true compromise. And depending on the lens to which you want to view it, then you can find fault with it, yet everyone gains and everyone probably misses out on a few items.
Tammy, one last point, though, and I want you to respond to this before I've got to get to a break. There's no question that Democrats feel that when President Biden compromised on a work requirement for food stamps, he crossed a line that Democrats in states across country and in Congress really believe should never be crossed, that work requirements for any form of federal assistance are simply wrong, correct?
I can see that, yet it doesn't help in reality. In reality, we have an aging workforce. In reality, we still need to get tax dollars in order to fund federal programs and state and local level programs. So from an ideal standpoint, perhaps I can see it, yet from a practical standpoint, it's not real.
Okay. We've got to get to our first break of the show. We're going to keep following the debt ceiling debate as it moves to the Senate. We'll be back with other stories in just a moment.
Thanks for listening to Political Rewind. If you like this show, you'll also like Georgia Today. It's a daily podcast from GPB News, bringing you compelling stories and in-depth reporting that you won't hear anywhere else. Join me, Peter Biello, for this quick and convenient way to get the best of GPB News' extensive coverage of the topics that matter to you, delivered directly to your device every weekday afternoon.
Tammy Greer, Chauncey Elkhorn, Margaret Coker, and Kevin Riley join me for today's Political Rewind. Kevin, controversy over the planned Atlanta Police Training Center is simply not going away. And in fact, there have been a couple of news stories in the past week, one of them that just broke overnight, that are going to do are going to simply gin up the controversy even more. Let's look at what we learned overnight. Three people have now been charged with fraud and money laundering in connection with the funds that have been raised to support opposition to the training center, according to the GBI. SWAT teams, uniformed officers, crime scene investigators from the Atlanta Police Department, I think the DeKalb Police Department were involved in part of this, made the arrests of these three people. I have to be quite honest, Kevin, the charges of money laundering and fraud for me are a little complicated right now. I have a hard time explaining them, and I think so do other people. We're going to learn more as these cases come to court, as there's arraignments and the like. But the fact is that this is another example of the fact that law enforcement is intending to get as tough as possible on the opponents of the training center.
Yeah, it is going to be hard to get a handle on this, Bill. I will mention for people who are interested in it, if you go to AJC.com, you can actually read the affidavits that were filed that resulted in the warrants. And I do think for average people, this is going to be one of those things like, what is going on? Why are they doing this? Why aren't we dealing with the actual issues at hand? The supporters of the protests and the folks who are actually protesting today at the DeKalb County Jail, even as we speak, are saying, hey, this was a classic effort to make sure that we had money to bail people out of jail when they got arrested during protests, which is a longstanding practice in organizations that protest that, you know, was a common thing in the civil rights movement. And then the GBI is saying, well, no, you were misleading people about your fundraising, and you are an organization that has been deemed dangerous, and therefore you can't raise money this way. I don't imagine they would file charges if they felt like they couldn't prove the charges or felt like they had a decent case and then arrest these people. But I do think it's going to just fuel the fire. I don't see any way it doesn't do that.
Yeah. And of course, Chauncey, we should point out this comes after we know any number of protesters have been charged with domestic terrorism and are facing significant charges. Now, the arrests in this case seem to be part of that classic line, follow the money.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of things that are not clear yet, but what is clear to me as we are preparing for the looming city council vote on using public funds to help construct the training center that critics call Cop City, is that folks in the Gold Dome and the governor's mansion, in addition to police forces, are committed to crippling what is likely to be an entrenched resistance effort from activists locally and from around the country to disrupt the deconstruction of this facility if and when it is approved and by city council members. They seem, committed to ensuring that what is likely to happen. They don't want Atlanta to become Portland or New York post the non-indictment of Daniel Pantaleo, the officer who was involved in Eric Garner's chokehold death. They don't want to see the ongoing anti-fascist resistance that you saw in Portland even to this day. Activists taking over sections of the downtown in Portland. They don't want that to happen here, and they're dead set on preventing it by any means necessary. And there are folks on the other side who are dead set on preventing the training center from being built by any means necessary. So it seems like a warning shot what's going to be, which could potentially be a long standing battle over this facility.
Tammy, Capital B, as well as other publications, also reported out a story that is fueling even more controversy. Atlanta City Council was preparing at one point, and Mayor Dickens said that the Atlanta share of building this training center was something like $31 million. It now turns out, Tammy, that in fact the city is on the hook for twice that amount through the leaseback arrangement that the contract calls for, in which the city will be paying a lease costs back to the training center for its use by their fire and police. So here's another matter that is just going to add more fuel to the fire.
Yeah, I'm unsure how the city of Atlanta can get out of its own way. I'm unclear of the lack of transparency with the city, with all of the things that have gone on. How is the city, the mayor, council members, all that's associated, the comms space, how are they not having a different thought that transparency is necessary in order to quiet down some of the critics? I also think it's interesting the push onto the police foundation. The police foundation is not elected by the people. So where are the elected officials and how are they handling this particular situation? I found the mayor's comments very interesting to the East Atlanta community. He has been out here talking, his staff members have been talking. That's great, but it's the quality, not the quantity. Where are the thoughtful responses back to the public on specific issues that they are concerned with? How did no one think that an additional $30+ million is going to have an impact on the city and the city's response, the people's response to that additional tax dollars, especially when we're already talking about the property taxes that those of us that live in the city, how much we incur and where's the money going? So I am very curious as to when someone is going to say, okay, let's be full with this. Let's have a document with headers to say, here's finances, here's the proposed activities, here is what we're doing from an environmental standpoint. The lack of clarity and the lack of transparency is almost creating the chaos. And I'm curious to see what is the next shoe to drop in this lack of transparency with the city of Atlanta.
Margaret, I want to bring you in, but I'll comment very quickly on what you're saying, Tammy. Part of this is the Atlanta Police Foundation is accountable to no one and has no transparency requirement for anybody, and they are driving this thing forward. Margaret?
Yeah, from Savannah, this feels like a discussion that's a way far away, but I will say that in these arguments about transparency and our public taxpayer dollars and our public servants, you know, if this is an issue that is engaging the residents in Greater Atlanta, then public servants have a duty to us all to be transparent about not only the plans for a facility, but also how they're going to pay for it. You know, here in coastal Georgia, I have to say the stories that we do time and again about public safety, the criminal justice system, and policing, you know, people from across all fault lines, no matter how much money you earn, what is the color of your skin, people want cops that they can trust. They want cops that are well-trained, and they want cops to obey the law and treat everyone equally. So there's, you know, those are the discussions that happen in our part of the state here. And I hope that there will be no more loss of life as the training center, Cop City in Atlanta, moves forward.
I think it's important to add that it's hard to overstate the influence of the Atlanta Police Foundation. We've done stories that show it's one of the most influential, powerful police foundations of any city in the country, and they have driven this process, and they've actually driven a lot of things in the city, many of which people are happy with and very proud of. For example, when you look at the camera system throughout Atlanta, which has, you know, been helpful in solving crimes and tracking down people, including in the recent Midtown shooting, the Police Foundation has been the place where that has found the money to do that, provided that, you know, created the help for the city there. They've also got a program that helps police officers buy homes in the city or in the areas where they work. So there are a lot of good things going on. So they're very influential, but I think something of this magnitude and its complexity and the necessity to build consensus among the neighborhoods, all of that seems to have put them in the spot of going too far, too fast. And until that can be resolved, I don't think this issue is going away.
Before we get off the subject, Chauncey, you've already said it, but let me ask you to talk about it a little bit more. You have every expectation that next week City Council will approve this deal that starts at $31 million, but again, will double with the leaseback arrangement.
I won't say that, you know, there's a certainty on this. I've spoken with multiple city council members who have said that they expect that it will be approved. There are certainly folks on council who are still undecided on how they will vote, and folks who have been dead set to vote against it regardless. It doesn't appear that the revelation late last week that the total cost to taxpayers is going to be at least $67 million, has changed anybody's minds. People who had intentions to vote for it have said that they still intend to. Folks who are against it still intend to. Folks who are on the fence are still on the fence and still listening to their constituents. That being said, I think that there, what is also clear from the council members, multiple council members who've talked to me, they feel the city has done a horrible job communicating about this from the jump. And that doesn't just include Mayor Andre Dickens' administration. That includes Keisha Lance Bottoms' administration. And they also say that they are concerned that the facility could end up costing more, even more than what has already been stated. There was a story we did at Capital B Atlanta on the Atlanta Department of Transportation hearing a week or two ago, where the current commissioner, Solomon Cavanaugh, had to get an earful from city council members about backlogs on road improvement projects that, you know, the city had allocated money for, that voters approved bond levies for in 2016. And Cavanaugh, who just started the job in January, you know, reported to council a few weeks ago that at least 38 of those projects haven't even are still in pre-construction phase, and it's 8 years later. So the cost of this could, of council members are worried that the training center could end up doing the same thing and costing folks down the road if, you know, inflated costs go up and things of that nature.
All right. Chauncey Alcorn gets the last word on this segment of Political Rewind. A lot more to talk about after these messages. You already earlier in the show referred to the fact that Savannah is going to send a pretty far right group of Republicans to the state convention in Columbus, which starts a week from tomorrow on Friday the 9th and Saturday the 10th, including Candace Taylor, former candidate for governor, who, by the way, believes the earth is flat and has talked about the conspiracy to assume that the earth is a globe, and she's been all over social media promoting her flat earth thinking. But that, nevertheless, what's interesting about next week is that Mike Pence was originally scheduled, as we all know, to be the keynote speaker on the Friday session of the convention. Trump will be the Saturday speaker. But in fact, now Pence has dropped out. Not quite clear why. His organization says he has some kind of town meeting a couple days before that. But David Schaefer, the chair of the party, has replaced Pence with Carrie Lake, who, of course, was the Republican candidate for governor in Arizona, one of the MAGA-ist of all candidates in the 2022 election cycle, and her presence there will simply more completely confirm that the state party is truly in the grip of MAGA thinkers.
Yeah, this is going to be quite an interesting event to attend and watch how everybody either tries to kiss and make up, or who tries to stand away from each other at on the podiums and the photo ops. I mean, I think that one of the people you just mentioned, David Schaefer, is one of the most powerful lightning rods that people who are attending the conference have to contend with. If you're going to run for president, like Mike Pence is expected to do, do you really want a photo with you and someone who might be indicted later this summer for breaking the laws in Georgia about the 2020 election and the fake elector scandal? I don't know that you do. I do know that if you are keeping your head up and trying to figure out what your next political moves are in terms of statewide office, you're going to go and figure out, again, get as many photo ops with you as with as many people as possible and use them for your campaign literature come next year. You know, I think that everyone in both the state Republican Party and nationally now are trying to figure out what is their risk and reward of coming to Georgia, the bellwether state that needs to flip back to red if people are going to win federal office, and and has this really, really rare, I think responsibility as well as power within the direction that we're going with American politics.
And of course, Kevin, Governor Kemp, Attorney General Chris Carr, and other state Republican leaders in office are boycotting the state convention. The governor has set up his own independent apparatus, a leadership group, and seems to have no interest in being part of the state GOP. Burt Jones, the lieutenant governor, highest ranking Republican, will be at that convention next week.
Well, it's true, and a couple things. I know that we can't have a show where we don't mention Marjorie Taylor Greene. She'll be there too, so we got that out of the way, Bill. All that said, let's remember just how far off the far afield Carrie Lake is. She ran for governor in Arizona in 2022, the last election, and lost. And she still hasn't conceded. She is still, I mean, so she's, you know, not conceding that. She's not conceding Donald Trump's election. So I think this idea that she can get on the bandwagon of the world is not round is not going to be a very big step. I mean, because apparently reality has basically no intrusion into her thinking, which is, I suppose, a gift in its way.
All right. Well, thank you for that, Kevin Riley. I'd like to move on to another subject. There's two more issues I'd really like to get in today. So I'm going to turn to you, Chauncey, and to you, Tammy, to help us with another story that has bubbled up to the surface in the last 24 hours. On Tuesday's show, we spent a good amount of time talking about the right-wing activists who have increasingly tried to start boycotts against businesses that support things they think are wrong. And the biggest example of that, of course, is that Target, which every year has promoted merchandise for the LGBT community during Pride Month, which is happening starting now, June, because of protesters, social media comments and the like, some actual fights in the stores themselves. In some stores, they've removed the LGBTQ-oriented merchandise. In others, they've put it in the back of the store. They've caved to the pressure. And now it appears that perhaps Chick-fil-A is going to be subjected to the same pressure because they just hired a vice president of diversity, equity, and inclusion. And there is a campaign out there on social media to say Chick-fil-A has, quote, gone woke, whatever the heck being woke means. Chauncey?
First of all, I just want to say Chick-fil-A is delicious, and I do not condone any Chick-fil-A slander. It's one of my favorite fast food restaurants and a staple of Georgia. But nevertheless, that's set aside. The interesting thing, the reports indicate that Chick-fil-A's had a DEI program since at least 2020. A lot of these major corporations have kind of upped the ante on their DEI efforts in the aftermath of the police murder of George Floyd more than 3 years ago now. And it's funny, you know, the way things work on Twitter and in social media when things get discovered or rediscovered. This is not a new thing for Chick-fil-A. Obviously, Chick-fil-A is also known as a conservative company, ironically, because of its stance on LGBTQ issues and the religious views of its founder. So it's ironic to a lot of people, including me, that this is the company that is being accused of being too woke when it was a company that conservatives championed along with Hobby Lobby and others, you know, even 5 years ago.
Yeah, I think, Tammy, that Chauncey makes a great point. It was the LGBT community and its supporters that wanted to boycott Chick-fil-A for so long because of Truett Cathy and his anti-gay pronouncements over the years. But again, we come back to this notion that what wokeness means and how activists are using it to go after big companies.
Yeah, woke doesn't mean what they think it means. And so because of that, then it's like hijacked the entire conversation. I think it's very interesting. This goes back to some of the conservative talk over the past 10 years or so about keeping the U.S. In a certain lens. And so those communities that have been traditionally underserved, underrepresented, focused on, it seems to, you know, that are getting some traction today, you know, goes along with this notion of replacement theory. And it just like stoking an emotional center rather than something that's logical.
Kevin, quick comment before we get to our last subject.
Quickly, well, as Chauncey, I think, made the point, I mean, Chick-fil-A is basically one of the major food groups if you're a Georgian. But one of the things I wanted to mention is that a few years back during the gay marriage controversy, our cartoonist Mike Luckovich did what was maybe my all-time favorite cartoon, in which the Chick-fil-A cows are objecting to the marriage of Bert and Ernie. And I'll send that to Natalie so that you guys can maybe post it on your site or on your social media, because it is a fantastic cartoon.
Thank you for that, Kevin. All right, Margaret, you mentioned it earlier in the show. You have a wonderful feature on The Current right now about a new state marker honoring a woman who was a genuine pioneer. We have just a couple minutes, but I really want you to tell us about her.
Yeah, you know, when wokeness becomes a talking point, I think we all deserve to go back to history to find out what our parties and our politics looked like 100 years ago. But here in Savannah, we had this extraordinary woman named Mamie George Williams, a Black woman who was born just after the end of the Civil War, someone who was one of the original suffragists. She was someone who used her talent, her education, her money to help register voters. She was the head of the Georgia Republican Party in 1920. She was the first American woman to speak at a national Republican convention. She was someone who had a national profile from little old Savannah. And it's extraordinary to me, you know, how voting matters, how people who were on the forefront of civic engagement always knew that voting matters, and how we can thread lots of different through lines of what Georgia politics are today by looking back at her and her extraordinary life.
And Margaret, talk just very quickly about when was this marker unveiled, and were members of her descendants of hers there to watch this happen?
Yeah, she was born, raised, and died here in Savannah. The marker was unveiled last Friday, and the sponsors of the marker were actually the Delta Thetas, the Black sorority. We also had the League of Women Voters, and the Georgia Historic Society. We didn't have any of her direct descendants there, but the marker stands right across the street from where she lived and across the street from another great civil rights monument here in Savannah, the Carnegie Library, where Black people were allowed to read books.
Thank you. It's a wonderful story. Kevin?
Yeah, and also, right, Margaret, that marker is the latest in the Georgia Historical Society's civil rights trail. And the Historical Society actually places and maintains the markers in our state. So they really do a great job with that.
Kevin, I think it's important and appropriate to give a shout-out to the Georgia Historical Society. They are extraordinary in the work they do here in our state. All right, we're out of time for today's show. Tammy Greer, Margaret Coker, Chauncey Elkhorn, and Kevin Riley, thank you so much for being with us today. By the way, a group of leaders in artificial intelligence, as you all may know by now, issued a report the other day that says that AI could lead to the extinction of humanity. And I mention that to you now because if you didn't hear our show last week with Paul Root Wolpe, the head of the Center for Ethics at Emory University, talking about all the ethical issues involved in artificial intelligence and chatbots, I really urge you to go back, listen to it on our podcast or on our website, because he speaks to the very thing that this latest reporting suggests. All right, that's it. We're going to be back again with a brand new show tomorrow morning. In the meantime, I'm Bill Nigut. Please take care, stay healthy, and be good to one another. Bye-bye, everybody.